as the proverb unpose, bruise leaves, leaves. In the case, Huangpo addressed his assembled monks and said, "You are all gobblers of bruised leaves. If you go about on pilgrimage like this, where will you have today? Do you know that there are no teachers of Chan in all of China?" A monk stepped forward and said, "But surely there are those in all regions who reform monks and govern assemblies of disciples." Huangpo said, "I do not say that there is no Chan, it's just that there are no teachers." So, please sit comfortably. So, talking here of Huangpo, he died in 850, one of the great masters of the Chan, of Chan in the Tang period. He was a student of Pai Chan, who in turn was a student of the great Matsu. And Pai Chan we meet in the Mumon Kan in case two, with dealing with a man who had been turned into a fox 500 times. But here, so Huangpo said physically he was very impressive, possibly 7 feet tall and broad with it. He is said to have a large callus on his forehead, the result of his constant prostrations to the mat, showing his humility. But in his old age he would say of himself, "When I was young I was a fierce tiger, but now I'm just a little pussycat." So that's the man. And when Huangpo first met his teacher Pai Chan, Pai Chan said, "Magnificent, imposing, where have you come from?" Huangpo said, "Magnificent and imposing, I've come from the mountains." Pai Chan said, "What have you come for?" Huangpo said, "I have not come for anything else than this." Pai Chan then led him into his community. Interesting question, interesting answer. So in the Zen tradition, the memory of Huangpo tends to be overshadowed by his famous successor, Lin Shi, who is better known by his Japanese name of Rinzai. Because in Japan, the two largest Zen sects we find there, and ones we mostly only hear about, are the Soto and the Rinzai. But there is, however, a smaller Obaku sect, or an Obaku is the Japanese pronunciation of Huangpo. So there's Obaku Zen as well, but it came into Japan during the Ming period rather than the Song. And these Obaku temples are distinguished by their colour things, whereas the older Zen temples tend to be more black and white, like you find around here. So to the koan. Now this koan is interesting in its depth and very challenging to both students of Zen and those who would call themselves teachers of Zen. Like most good koans, it keeps us from getting above our station. As the scene opens, we find Huangpo addressing the monks in his assembly. "All of you are gobblers of brewers' lees." So, what is this? After the brewers has extracted the essential alcohol or alcoholic ingredients, say from rice, wine, perhaps, the lees are what's left over. One might call them a low-grade intoxicant with little power to be effective. So quite a rebuke, one might say, and this statement is followed by a searching question. He said, "If you go about on pilgrimage like this, where will you find today?" And so we may well ask, going about like what? What are these brewer's leaves? What is Huangpo getting at? Is he being critical of the monks, or is he suggesting that they might be missing something important? So at the end of the long summer retreat, it was traditional for monks to leave the community in which they had been practicing and go around visiting teachers in other temples, and even hermits of renown if they could track them down. Perhaps one could describe them as a kind of Chan tourist. Probably monks discussed among themselves the relative merits and qualities of teachers and decided whom they may want to visit perhaps even challenge in Dharma combat. I suspect they also exchange information concerning which monasteries serve the tastiest food or have the best scenery. For many, it was not a serious enterprise. You know how it is. Should we join Savannah at Gorik's Run, sleep on the ground and pee on the grass? Or should we wait for Amasami to come and enjoy hot baths, warm beds and freshly baked scones for morning tea? Decisions. What's really important? No doubt it was a great adventure for the monks, with no guarantee of the outcome. And our koans are replete with examples of encounters between travelling monks and Zen adepts. Most of the time, the master's arrows missed their mark, not because the masters weren't good shooters. And the monks travelled on oblivious to an opportunity lost. Sometimes the arrow struck home. Regard. Tungshan came to see Yunmen. Yunmen asked him, "Where were you most recently?" Tungshan said, "At Jutu." Yunmen said, "Where were you during the summer?" Tungshan said, "At Paopsu Monastery in Hunan." Yunmen said, "When did you leave there?" Tungshan said, "August 25th. Yunmen said, "I spare you 60 bows." Basically, you say you're not worth the effort. So Tungshan would not have slept well that night, and indeed he didn't. Because the story goes on. It says, Tungshan came again and said, "Yesterday you said you spared me 60 blows. I don't know where I was at fault." It's really lovely. "I don't know where I was at fault." True humility. Authentic inquiry. Yunmen said, "You rice bag, you go about in such a way, now west of the river, now south of the lake." With this, Tungshan had great awakening. We'll return to this later. But just a note to our Western ears, this expression, west of the river, south of the lake, sounds like a poetic metaphor. But for the monks of the time, it had real import. And our koans often have historical and literary significance that escapes us because we don't have the cultural references to guide us. And this is a case in point. Let me explain. The sixth patriarch Huineng had many heirs, and among them was Nan Hui and Qing Yuan. They stand out. Nan Hui is one of the five holy mountains of China, and Master Nan Hui Huijian taught there. Master Xingsu made the Dharma blossom at his monastery in the Qing Yuan Plains. Each had many successors. But west of the Yangtze River, it was Master Matsu Doitsu, who was Nan Hui's heir, and south of the Dorte Lake, Qing Yuan's heir was Shi Tou. These two teachers were called the two Dharma gates of Zen, or Chan, of the Chan world at the time. And unless you knocked on their gates, it was considered that you were not qualified as a Zen monk. Thus, the Zen way and the Buddha Dharma flourished under the disciples of Bodhidharma, and their Dharma heirs spread it throughout China. So when he's saying, west of the river, south of the lake, that's what he's getting at. So again, it's all part of the culture and what they're doing. So despite Huang Po's seeming criticism, pilgrimage was an established practice for the monks in the Tang period and indeed a necessary part of their training. Indeed, the great Joshu, who we met yesterday, right? 40 years after his great awakening, he spent a further 20 years on pilgrimage, polishing his understanding. So it's no small thing, this pilgrimage business. For this reason alone, we must not be too hasty in reaching a conclusion about Huang Po's motives in cautioning his monks. Now, it may be assumed that Huang Po, in calling his monks gobblers and dregs, was saying that they were just going around listening to various leaders of assemblies and picking up second-hand ideas, the writings and saying of others. But to do so would be to devalue the words of the Buddha Shakyamuni and the old masters of our line, and even the little boss up in the end here. her words, golden nectar. So we should be careful when interpreting Bodhidharma's declaration that Zen is a special teaching outside the sutras, no reliance on words and letters, a direct transmission from heart to heart. He says no reliance on words and letters, not no use for words and letters. While experience comes first, words follow, but they're important. And in the preference to the Mumon Khan, one of our koan collections, Mumon has this to say: the Buddha mind and words point the way. The gateless barrier is the entry. There is no gate from the beginning, so how do you pass through it? Haven't you heard that things that come in through the gate are not the family treasure? Things gained from caused circumstances have a beginning and an end, formation and destruction. Such talk raises waves where there is no wind and gouges wounds in healthy flesh. How much more foolish are those who depend on words and seek understanding by their intellect. They try to hit the moon with a stick. They scratch their shoe when their feet itch. But he says there, the Buddha, mind and words point the way. They work together for our salvation and the salvation of others. The Buddha mind guides us. It brings us here. While the words provide a map. But words are not the thing to which they point, and a map is not the territory. Another monk of old times tells us of his pilgrimage experience. Yung Chia Xuan Cui. He is author of the Shodoka, which we read in the afternoons. I suppose we're reading it this week, wasn't he? Yeah. He has this to say: I wandered over rivers and seas, crossing mountains and streams, visiting teachers, asking about the way in personal interviews. Since I recognize the sixth founding teacher at Zhao Qi, I know what is beyond the relativity of birth and death. And this is the great matter, knowing what is beyond the relativity of birth and death. And in his Song of Zazen, which we recite in the evening, Hakuin also tells us that the human condition is one of wandering. Lost on dark paths of ignorance, we wander through the six worlds. From dark path to dark path we wander. When shall we be freed from birth and death? And this is the import of Huang Po's message to his monks. Like us, they're lost on dark paths of ignorance. And like us, they don't have Yung Chia's knowledge of what is beyond birth and death. And it's this lack of knowledge that is of concern to Huang Po. Just wandering about gobbling brewer's leaves will not save us. This is not the way to find today. And just like Huang Po's monks, we are constantly looking beyond our present circumstances, seeking something else. I wonder when supper will be served. I wonder if this talk will be over. I can't wait until Friday when I can go home. What am I doing here? We believe that heaven, truth and nirvana lie elsewhere, so we keep searching. Our gaze is fixed on something beyond the horizon, never where we are. And when we behave this way, how can we find today? So Huang Po is not saying that the monks should not go on pilgrimage. What he is telling them is that they should not expect to be taught anything useful. Recall the words of Mumon, just read. Haven't you heard that things that come in through the gate are not the family treasure? Why? Because there's no one in all of Tang China at the time who could teach the monks the essential matter. And it's as true of Australia today. While it can be realised, it can't be taught. As Huang Po well understood, the leaders of Zen assemblies can't talk us out of our deluded condition. Talk, for the most part, usually tends to reinforce it. The best they can do is to provide learning opportunities for those of us who visit them and wish to learn. You recall the story I told you earlier about the encounter between Yunmen and Tungshan that ended in this, with this remark. Yunmen said, "You rice bag, do you go about in such a way, now west of the river, now south of the lake?" With this, Tungshan had great awakening. Now, superficially, it would seem that Yunmen did not teach Tungshan anything at all. And in a sense, it's true. Nevertheless, Tungshan had great awakening. So what went on between these two worthies that gave such a positive result? What was it that Tungshan awakened to? Can Yunmen be called a teacher? If so, what did he teach? Or should we see his function as that of a midwife, helping the student to give birth to that which is already within? But what sort of teaching is this? Last night we heard, this afternoon, sorry, we heard, a monk asked Joshu, "Does a dog have Buddha nature or not?" Joshu answered, "Moo." Moo? That's it? That's all he said? What kind of an answer is that? You may well ask, is it a teaching? Well, there's no record of what happened to the monk, but I am grateful for his question. That Mu Joshu has been making trouble ever since, and long may it do so. And then there's Big Daddy, the great Shakyamuni himself. He held up a flower, twirled it and winked. The assembly was dumbfounded, as well they might be. Mahakashyapa alone smiled, or as some reports have it, he cracked his face. He was a very serious fellow, and he smiled at seeing a flower. And for that he received transmission of the eye treasury of the law, and there has been an uninterrupted chain reaction of transmissions ever since. Well, will it all end? Will it be next Saturday? Who knows? What does the twirling of fire have to do with anything profound? On attending a funeral, you may demand to know, living or dead, living or dead. But the best answer you will get is, I can't say living, I can't say dead. You may ask, if you're a teacher, why can't you say? Aren't teachers supposed to know the answers to questions such as these? Well, there's a problem here. You see, one can't give a straight answer to a crooked question. And there are lots of crooked questions in the world, right? One of the big ones is, who am I? Not good. What teachers can do is ask straight questions. And they do. What is Mu? What is the sound of a single hand? Who is hearing? What is your original face before you were born? I mean, they don't come much straighter than that. Very clear. Unfortunately, questions such as these have been seized upon by Western academics who twist and bend them. Then they have the hide to write learned papers about the irrationality of Zen. I think they missed the point. So we should not expect too much of our teachers. The teachers may be able to give a peck in response to the student's scratching, but it's up to the student to work a way out of the shell. As Zen Master Ikkyu wrote, "I like to offer something to help you, but in the Zen school, we don't have a single thing." So if you're looking for a guru to save you, you've come to the wrong place. Around here, the only gurus are kangaroos. And it's always going to be that way. I recall an event way back at Session in the early 80s. At this session, we had Sosan with Eiken Roshi for the first time. This is public dialogue, where the teacher sits at the end and students go up and ask questions in a public way, expose their guts. I asked him, "The Buddha Shakyamuni said, all beings are from the beginning Buddha. Only their ignorance and delusion prevents them from attesting to this fact." Well-known quote. And my thing. So I said, "Then why is there ignorance rather than enlightenment, if all beings from the beginning are Buddha?" So, you know, why all the suffering that follows from this ignorance? And Aitken Roshi said, I don't know. And I said, if you don't know, why are you a Roshi? And he said, sometimes I feel inadequate for the task. Reflecting on this later, I appreciate, really grateful, appreciated Aitken Roshi's humanity as shown in his ignorance and humility. It allowed me in my ignorance to identify with him, relate to him. And such relating would be impossible with the superhuman characters we hear of that exist in other traditions, you know, those who can sort of float, meter above the ground and do all sorts of wonderful things like that. I can't identify with that. So the monks of Huang Po's time are really no different from people of today, no different from us. Most of our life is taken up with thoughts of the past and dreams of the future. And all of these focus on the I as ego. And in concentrating on the ego and its desire for security, we lose sight of our true nature. And the Surangama Sutra teaches us, from the beginningless past, right up to your present existence, you have mistakenly regarded a thief as your own child. And your changeless, original nature has thus been lost to you. Because of that, you have been transmigrating through the cycle of birth and death. Think of that. Your changeless, original nature has thus been lost to you. So how can that be? How can we lose that which is fundamentally us, our self-nature? Well, it's not so much that we lose it as we lose sight of it. While it's there, it's always there, it can't be seen. Why? Because we've fallen under a spell. We've been enchanted by the magic of our mind. Because the mind has spun a web of deceit in which our attention has become entangled, a fundamental aspect of our practice is free our awareness from this entanglement. So in the Buddha Mind School, meditation, Zazen, is the heart of practice, and the goal is awakening. For both Dogen and Hakuin, two of our ancestral teachers, the Zazen of the Mahayana is the Alpha and Omega of the Buddha Way. Both insisted on the necessity of awakening, which is an integral aspect of Mahayana Buddhism. Hakuin insists on the absolute need for insight. He says, everyone who belongs to the school of Zen should understand. There exists in our school an essential matter that can only be penetrated in great awakening. I want all of you to be aware that the study of Zen can effect a miraculous transformation that will change you to the very marrow of your bones. And this essential matter is the Buddha nature. So how do we go about seeing our Buddha nature? Well, the only way to realise it is through our living experience. It's impossible to understand it by attempting to understand the meaning of words. Reality is ineffable. So to realise reality, we must put a stop to the habitual flow of words that constitute our normal state of consciousness. And Basui says, if you want to understand your self-nature, just stop your activity and look within. All are equipped with this original nature, and each one of you is perfect. This nature is master of seeing, hearing, and understanding, and is called the Buddha of great penetration and superior wisdom. Just there. You see, it's the concepts we've developed about who we are and what the world is that hinder us. The one thing that stands between us and our true nature. And Sogyal Rinpoche states quite unambiguously, more and more I have come to realise how thoughts and concepts are all that block us from always being quite simply in the absolute. And so we can see why, within our Zen tradition, Mumon instructs us, says, for subtle realisation, it is of utmost importance that you cut off the mind road. And in his commentary on this case, Our old teacher, Eikon Roshi, concludes with this statement. Preoccupied with brooding, fantasy, memory, or whatever, you are unable to hear the thrush in the avocado tree or to smell the kahiliki, the frangipani, in the early evening. What a loss. Yeah? And the birds and the flowers here. Yeah? Preoccupied with brooding, fantasy, memory, or whatever. Anybody put their hand up to that? No. No. We're doing okay. So a 12th century Chan master says this: abandon all the workings of your relative consciousness which you have been cherishing since eternity. Retire within your inner being and see into the reason of it. As your self-reflection grows deeper and deeper, the moment will surely come when the spiritual flower will suddenly burst into bloom, illuminating the entire universe. The experience is incommunicable, though you yourself know perfectly well what it is. This is the moment when you can transform this great earth into solid gold and the great rivers into an ocean of milk. What a satisfaction this is to your daily life. Yeah? Who needs to wander around anywhere after that? Being so, do not waste your time with words and phrases or by searching for the truth of Zen in books, for the truth is not to be found there. So for our practice, you have to exhaust all your powers of searching and contriving and concentrate all your energies on a single point. When one's mind is so fully occupied with a single thought that takes place a sudden awakening within oneself and the issues are resolved or actually dissolved, all the problems that we carry. So it need not take much on the part of the teacher. The answer is not in the teacher's speech or gesture, but in the questioner's mind, which is now awakened. So what all awakening experiences have in common is a cessation of thought. There is a stopping of the conscious mind that spends its time weaving the particular phenomenal world in which each of us dwells privately. It ceases to function, and when it does, the familiar world that each of us is so readily identifies with collapses. And reality is revealed. It's always been there, of course, but we couldn't see it because of the obscuring fog of thought and belief. And then we have this rather lovely, one can say then, by letting go of our thoughts about I when doing Zazen, we wake up to the reality of life which pervades the whole universe. So when Gautama the Buddha attained an awakening, he was able to say, I attained the way simultaneously with the whole world and all sentient beings. Look around you. With all sentient beings. Everything, mountains, rivers, trees, grass, attained Buddhahood. The basic fact is that the self is living out a non-dual life which pervades all living things which exist. And among us, Dairyu, the body of colour perishes. Here, colour and form in Chinese, the same word. The body of form, the body of colour perishes. What is the solid Dharma body? What's that? True thing. Thinking about something marvellous. Dairyu said, the mountain flowers bloom like brocade. The river between the hills is blue as indigo. So just a little passing word, closing word, Huangpo. It said, during Huangpo's time, he left all the monks who followed him and became involved in the general work of Ta An Monastery. He retired, where his continuous practice consisted of sweeping out all the rooms. He swept the Buddha hall and the Dharma hall, but it was not continuous practice done for the sake of sweeping out the mind, nor was it continuous practice performed in order to cleanse the light of the Buddha. It was continuous practice done for the sake of continuous practice. Very lovely. So, we all live out the reality of one life. All living things, all existence is living out the reality of one life, which is all-pervading. But if we don't awaken to this simple fact, we live a life of pain and poverty. So please sit with sincerity and don't take yourself too seriously.